the letters getting smaller toward the end of each sentence. It was a problem he always had with the blackboard. He started big and seemed to shrink as he went. Scratching the beard on his chin, he wondered what this said of him, what it portended. There was a lot wrong with what he'd written, he thought. The fifth line was untrue, the one about nobody calling him Jimmy. Above the poem, he had written, "I am Jimmy." He still thought of himself as Jimmy. He grabbed the stiff rag he'd left in the chalk tray, stood before his poem, and went to erase the line that wasn't right. But something stopped him. It was the fear of making the poem worse by attempting to fix it, the fear of taking a line away and having nothing good to put in its place. This was his voice, and it was too rare a thing to quash. Jimmy felt Mrs. Pearson's eyes upon him. He felt the eyes of his classmates. The ghosts were watching, the corpses laughing, while he studied the problem on the board. When the solution came, it brought a familiar thrill of arriving at the right place, of connecting the dots. Jimmy reached up and slapped the dusty rag against the board and erased the first thing he'd written. The words, "I am Jimmy," disappeared into a white smear and a tumbling haze of powder. He set the rag aside and began to write a truth in its place. "I am solitude," he started to write. He liked the sound of that. It sounded poetic and full of meaning, but like poetry was wont to do, the words had a mind of their own. His deep thoughts intervened, and so he wrote something different. He shortened it to two little neat circles, a swerve, and a slash. Grabbing his bag, he left the room and his old friends behind. All that remained was a poem and the call to be remembered, a mark to prove he'd been there. "I am solo." And a haze of chalk fell through the air like the ghost of unwritten words.
Silo 1, the year 2345. Chapter 85. Donald steered the empty wheelchair back to Dr. Wilson's office. A damp blanket was draped over the armrests and dragged across the tile. He felt numb. His dream that morning had been to give life, not take it. The permanence of what he'd done began to set in, and Donald found it difficult to swallow, to breathe. He stopped in the hallway and took stock of what he'd become. Unknowing architect, prisoner, puppet, hangman. He wore a different man's clothes. His transformation horrified him. Tears welled up in his eyes, and he wiped them away angrily. All it took was thinking of Helen and Mick, of the life taken from him. Everything leading up to that point in time, to him awakening in that silo, had been someone else's doing. He could feel parted strings dangling from his elbows and knees. He was a loose puppet steering an empty wheelchair back to where it belonged. Donald parked the chair and set the brakes. He took the plastic vial out of his pocket and considered stealing another dose or two. Sleep would be hard to come by, he feared. The vial went back into the cabinet full of empties. Donald turned to go when he saw the note left in the middle of the gurney. "You forgot this. Wilson." The note was stuck to a slender folder. Donald remembered handing it to Dr. Wilson along with the reactor tech's belongings. The trip to the other two lockers had been a blur. All he could remember was clutching his phone, facts coming together, realizing that Anna had played Mick and Thurman to engineer a last-minute switch that made no sense, that could only happen with a daughter bending her father's ear. Thus his life had been stolen away. The folder had been in the locker Anna had mentioned to her father in the message. It seemed inconsequential now. Donald balled up the note from Dr. Wilson and tossed it in the recycling bin. He grabbed the folder with the intention of staggering back to his cot and searching for sleep, but he found himself opening it up instead. There was a single sheet of paper inside. An old sheet of paper. It had yellowed, and the edges were rough where bits had flaked off over the years. Below the single-spaced typing, there were five signatures, a mix of florid and subdued penmanship. At the top of the document, boldly typed, it read, "Re the Pact." Donald glanced up at the door. He turned and went to the small desk with the computer, placed the folder by the keyboard, and sat down. Anna's note to her father had the same words in the subject line, along with "urgent." He had read the note a dozen times to try and divine its meaning, and the number in the note had led him to this folder. He was familiar enough with the Pact of the Silos, the governing document that kept each facility in line, that managed their populations with lotteries, that dictated their punishments from fines to cleanings. But this was too brief to be that pact. It looked like a memo from his days on Capitol Hill. Donald read. "All. It has been previously discussed that 10 facilities would suffice for our purposes, and that a time frame of 1 century would perform an adequate cleanse. With members of this pact both familiar with budget underruns and how battle plans prove fruitless upon first firing, it should surprise no one that facts have changed our forecast. We are now calling for 30 facilities and a 2-century time frame. The tech team assures me their progress makes the latter feasible. These figures may be revisited once again. There was also discussion in the last meeting of allowing 2 facilities to reach E-Day for redundancy, or the possibility of holding 1 facility back in reserve. That has been deemed inadvisable. Having all baskets in 1 egg is better than the danger of allowing 2 or more eggs to hatch. As it is a source of growing contention, this amendment to the original pact shall be hereby undersigned by all founding persons and considered law. I will take it upon myself to work E-shift and pull the lever. Long-term survivability prospects are at 42% in the latest models. Marvelous progress, everyone. V." Donald scanned the signatures a second time. There was Thurman's simple scrawl, recognizable from countless memos and bills on the Hill. Another signature that might be Erskine's, one that looked like Charles Rhodes, the swaggering Oklahoma governor. Illegible others. There was no date on the memo. He read over it again. Understanding dawned slowly, full of doubts at first, but solidifying. There was a list he remembered from his previous shift, a ranking of silos. Number 18 had been near the top. It was why Victor had fought so hard to save the facility. This decision, he mentions in the memo, pulling the lever. Had he said something about this in his note to Thurman? In his admission before he killed himself? Victor had grown unsure of whether or not he could make some decision. Baskets in 1 egg. That wasn't how the saying went. Donald leaned back in the chair, and one of the light bulbs in Dr. Wilson's desk lamp flickered. Bulbs were not meant to last so long. They went dark. But there were redundancies. 1 egg. Because what would they do to each other if more than 1 were allowed to hatch? The list. The reason it all fell together for Donald so easily was because he already knew, had always known. How could it be otherwise? They had no plan, these bastards, of allowing the men and women of the silos to go free. No. There could be only 1. For what would they do to each other if they met hundreds of years hence on the hills outside? Donald had drawn this place. He should have always known. He was an architect of death. He thought about the list, the rankings of the silos. The one at the top was the only one that mattered. But what was their metric? How arbitrary would that decision be? All those eggs slaughtered except for one? With what hope? What plan? That the differences and struggles among the silos people can be overcome? And yet the differences between the silos themselves was too much? Donald coughed into his trembling hand. He understood what Anna was trying to tell him. And now it was too late. Too late for answers. This was the way of life and death, and in a place that ignored both, he'd forgotten. There was no waking anyone. Just confusion and grief. His only ally, gone. But there was another he could awake. The one he'd hoped to from the beginning. This was a grave power, this ability to bestir the dead. Donald shivered as he realized what the pact truly meant, this pact between madmen who had conspired to destroy the world. "It's a suicide pact," he whispered, and the concrete walls of the silo closed in around him. They wrapped him like the shell of an egg never meant to be hatched. For they were the most dangerous of them all, this pit of vipers, and no world would ever be safe with them in it. The women and children were in the lifeboats, only to urge the men of Silo One to keep working their shifts. But they were all meant to drown. Every last one of them. Silo 17. The year 2323. Year 12. Chapter 86. Solo didn't set out one day to plumb the silo's depths. It simply happened. He'd explored enough in both directions over the years, had hidden from the sound of others fighting, had found the messes they left behind. But such encounters grew rarer, and so his explorations grew bolder. It was curiosity as much as gravity and despair that drove him down. It was these things that ended his days alone. He scavenged as he went. On 120 he discovered the lower farms and the signs of those who had lived there. This was farther than he'd ever been before. Those who had survived the early days had rigged the farms with wires and makeshift pipes. Solo took some carrots and beets from the overgrowth and left with the feeling of ghosts watching him. Outside, realizing how close he was to fabled supply, the subject of so much radio chatter, he spiraled deeper. Supply was the land of plenty, or so they used to say. The promise of batteries and a can opener tugged him along. The door to supply was locked. Solo felt eyes on him as he crouched by the entrance and pressed his ear against the cool steel. There was a thrumming he felt as much as heard. It seemed far away, like the lungs of the silo somewhere distant, rattling and wheezing. He tried the door again. It wouldn't budge. There were no locks visible on the outside, just the standard vertical handles, big enough for one hand to grab and pull. Solo retreated to the staircase. He lightly gripped the railing with both hands, and listened. He listened hard. Eventually, he heard his own pulse in his ears. That's when he knew he was listening best. No ghosts. No tremble to the rail. He checked his rifle, made sure the safety was off, then pulled it tight against his shoulder. He aimed for the place between the double doors where the handles met. He pictured a can sitting there, imagined kicking it, tried not to see the chest of a man. He squeezed the trigger so lightly and gradually that when the bullet exploded out the barrel, it startled him. The boom of the shot reverberated up and down the silo, a loud crack and then a dozen echoes. Solo took aim again and fired a second round, A third. Boom. Boom. The ghosts would be everywhere cowering, he figured. He was solo, but his rifle gave him noisy company. He slipped the rifle strap over his head and tried the doors. One of them moved a little. Solo stepped back and kicked the door, even though they opened outward, just to put some violence into whatever bits continued to hold. When he pulled it the next time, the door came free with a grinding noise. Debris rained out of the insides and clattered onto the landing. The holes on the inside of the door were much larger than the holes on the outside, and the metal was bright and shiny where it had peeled away. Sharp to the touch, too, Solo discovered, sucking on his finger. The silence within supply seemed powerful after the boom of his rifle. Solo approached the counter that stretched from wall to wall,